MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, Colin Powell reportedly makes an end run around the Defense Department.
And Goodwill Ambassador Jessica Lange goes to Congo to highlight systematic rape.
When they are recruited, of course, a lot of the enticement is that they would have carte blanche to rape, to loot. It is a way of paying back the soldiers on the ground.
Also, was it a debate or a casting call? 5 candidates take the stage in California. 9 Democrats go at it tonight in New Mexico.
And to lure Latin voters, Republicans try to talk the talk.
Buenos dias. ¿Cómo está?
Muy bien. Not bad. Not bad. These stories and more coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld is in Baghdad to meet with troops and military commanders. The top U.S. commander in Iraq, Lieutenant Ricardo Sanchez, said he'd like to have some more international troops to help with security. NPR's Ivan Watson tells us the U.S. is struggling to secure the country.
There is definitely a major security issue here. The U.S. cannot secure the major highways around Iraq. There is a great deal of banditry on some of the key roads. In fact, U.S. forces are coming under attack many times a day, losing lives, having soldiers injured and killed almost every day here. So the issue that if a larger conflict erupted here, the commander here is saying, I do not have enough forces to deal with this properly. This has been one of the strongest statements yet from a U.S. commander here, arguing for contributions of additional forces.
NPR's Ivan Watson in Baghdad. The U.S. has begun circulating a new U.N. resolution to get more countries to send troops to Iraq, but today France and Germany said the resolution falls short. Miguel Estrada, President Bush's controversial nominee to the Federal Appeals Court in Washington, D.C., has withdrawn his name from consideration. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Democrats have blocked a vote on Estrada for months, insisting that the Bush administration release memos the nominee wrote when he served in the Justice Department. The administration refused and sought to force a vote on the Senate floor 7 times. Each time, though, the GOP fell short of the 60 votes needed to cut off a Democratic filibuster. The 41-year-old Estrada, a Honduran immigrant, was the first Hispanic nominee to the important D.C. Court of Appeals, and Republicans have used the Democrats' filibuster on the nomination against them in ads aired in Hispanic areas. In a letter written to President Bush, Estrada said he was withdrawing because, quote, the time has come to return my full attention to the practice of law and to regain the ability to make long-term plans for my family. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
A hurricane warning is in effect for Bermuda as Hurricane Fabian moves in on the island. Meteorologist Richard Posch of the National Hurricane Center says the storm is large and it's dangerous.
It's a very powerful hurricane. It's weakened a little bit. The hurricane hunters flew in there and found the winds were down slightly, about 120 miles per hour, but that's still a very dangerous Category 3 hurricane, and there is even the potential for it to regain a little bit of that strength over the next day or so.
Tropical storm force winds are expected to reach Bermuda early tomorrow, well in advance of the eye of the storm, and large swells will begin to spread along parts of the U.S. Atlantic coast today. Stocks are mixed at this hour. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 2 points to 95.67. The Nasdaq's up 4 to 18.57. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, the Institute for Supply Management says the U.S. services sector was unchanged in August at 65.1. That matches the July reading, which was the highest since the survey was first conducted in July of 1997. Any reading above 50 indicates growth. The sector includes businesses ranging from restaurants to retail stores to tourism. It comprises about 80% of the U.S. economy. Hewlett-Packard says it stands by its forecast for the current quarter, which ends October 31st. The company expects revenues of nearly $19 billion. That's about $1 billion more than a year ago. Jason Lopez reports from San Francisco.
Analysts describe Hewlett-Packard's performance in the last quarter as inconsistent. The firm disappointed investors by missing profit and revenue expectations, but HP's chief financial officer says earnings projections are on target for this quarter. The company is embarking on a $300 million marketing campaign aimed at corporate customers and consumers. CEO Carly Fiorina told the San Jose Mercury News that Hewlett-Packard wants consumers to associate the company with being hip and modern. Many analysts applaud the transformation, especially on the heels of the $19 billion merger with Compaq, but they say HP also needs to put together a string of consistent quarters. For NPR News, I'm Jason Lopez in San Francisco.
The European Central Bank has left interest rates unchanged. Bankers say prospects for economic recovery later this year have improved, and they say inflation remains under control. Economists expect the European Central Bank to keep rates at the current 2% level at least through November. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, now in its 25th year.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
A breakthrough today for enlisting international military help in post-war Iraq. Russia has now indicated its willingness to send troops. France and Germany are still holding back. But clearly, new dynamics are at play now that the Bush administration's reversed course, some would say dined out on crow, on involving the UN in Iraq. The behind-the-scenes story on the Bush administration and the UN involvement is vividly reported this morning in The Washington Post, featuring a seeming end run by Secretary of State Colin Powell around Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. We're joined now by Glenn Kessler, who covers the State Department for The Washington Post and contributed to today's Post story. Welcome, Glenn.
Well, glad to be with you.
Glenn, what was it? What was it? Most basically, that seemed to turn the ship of state around on this one.
Well, the key moment occurred when the military in the Pentagon, particularly the Joint Chiefs, decided to support the State Department's efforts to get a UN resolution that would assure other nations to contribute troops.
But the president went on vacation for the whole month of August. This was sort of in the air, but it didn't seem all that likely, such a dramatic turnaround on the UN. What happened when the president came back from Crawford, Texas?
Well, the first day he was back, Colin Powell walked in and basically said he had the backing of the Joint Chiefs for a resolution that would basically put U.S. forces as part of a multinational force commanded by an American that would have the approval of the United Nations.
The president didn't put up any resistance?
Well, in this case, it was more or less a fait accompli. It was quite a dramatic turnabout because the White House had been kind of distant to these suggestions before Tuesday. And in fact, when Deputy Secretary Armitage had floated it, the White House notably did not embrace it.
Yeah, but Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage kind of a week or two ago sort of suddenly kind of floated all this out there into the news ether.
Right, but it was never embraced by the White House, and even at the morning of Tuesday, the White House press secretary was kind of dismissing it as one of many ideas out there. But once Secretary Powell had the support of the Joint Chiefs, it's very difficult for the rest of the Pentagon or the White House to basically say, well, we're not going to pay attention to what the Joint Chiefs say they need in Iraq.
So how adept, just bureaucratically, playing the power game was Secretary of State Colin Powell in all this?
Well, I think he was very adept. What you had was, and this is according to the people that we spoke to for the article, he waited to the exact moment when he could exert the most amount of leverage and that when he had the powerful partners in making the case, and that was the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It's worth noting, of course, is that Secretary Powell once was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and many of the people that now run the military once were reported to him.
Does this diminish the Secretary of Defense's stature at all?
Well, you know, this is a question. People, it's a parlor game in Washington. The general thing that has happened here is that Powell may win some of these battles, but Rumsfeld wins quite a few himself, and we'll just have to see what the next round shows.
Mm-hmm. Glenn Kessler, thanks very much for joining us on this.
Glad to do it.
Glenn Kessler covers the State Department for The Washington Post.
Let the debates begin. Five of 135 candidates running to recall California Governor Gray Davis appeared in their first debate last night. Tonight, the nine Democrats running for president will fill up the stage in their party's first televised debate in New Mexico. Joining us on the line to handicap the debates are Charlie Cook, editor and publisher of the Cook Political Report. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And Professor Tom Holohan from the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California. He's an expert on debates and political communication. Tom, welcome.
Hi.
And let's start with you in California first. Arnold Schwarzenegger declined to participate in last night's debate. Instead, he seemed to spend the day wiping an egg off his jacket. He got hit at a rally by an egg. He will take part in a debate later this month where all the candidates are going to get to see the questions in advance. Did more people end up talking about the fact that he wasn't there than about what happened there?
Well, Schwarzenegger is clearly trying to run a risk-averse campaign, and I think that's the way it's being framed by the media and by people on the street in California. Not very many people probably tuned into the debate last night anyway, so the question will be, was his presence even missed by the people who vote?
Gray Davis started off by taking 30 minutes of questions from a panel, and then the five of the 135 debated. But, Tom, can they really debate when there's so many?
Well, it's not a debate in the academic debate sense of the term, but it is an important opportunity for people to identify the issues that each of the candidates most strongly represent and to try to make distinctions between the candidates. Mm-hmm. For Gray Davis, it was a chance to try to overcome the image that he's really the dead man walking and to try to communicate to voters that he's in touch and that he shares their feelings of pain and concern.
And briefly, did he?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. Gray Davis exclaimed at one point, you know, I have a passion for education, but everything about his nonverbal communication and his demeanor denied any notion that this was a man of passion. He seems unable to communicate empathy, and unfortunately, in an era of mediated campaigns, empathy may be the thing that voters most look for in candidates.
Mm. Well, Charlie, let's move to the Democratic presidential race. Former Vermont Governor Howard Dean was the only presidential candidate making an appearance in New Mexico before tonight's scheduled debate. He drew 200 people to a Santa Fe coffee house last night. The last time he was in the state in June, he was a long shot. How about tonight's debate? Is it all about Dean versus everyone else?
Well, I think debates in primaries this far out really aren't terribly important. I mean, it's just going to be a tiny, tiny, tiny number of people who are going to watch it. It's not like debates in the presidential general election campaign. So I think, frankly, I doubt if a lot of people are going to be talking about this debate a week from now.
But what will the debaters talk about? John Kerry on Sunday started to talk about Howard Dean's lack of foreign policy credentials. Joe Lieberman has been saying he worries that he can't be elected. Should they be attacking one of their own or attacking the Republican candidate?
Well, there's a danger in a multi-candidate field of A attacking B, because B's support, even if it drops off, it goes to C. You know, it's not a zero-sum game. So that these kinds of attacks and those kinds of debates really don't work terribly well. But this is obviously going to be who's going to be the alternative to Dean.
And Tom Holohan, another candidate, might not even be there tonight. Former NATO commander Wesley Clark finally revealed that he is a Democrat. People weren't sure of his affiliation. And some say that he's closer to running. What do you think his impact will be?
Well, my guess is he's probably closer to running for the vice presidential spot. I think the remarkable story is that other than Howard Dean, that none of the other candidates seem to have caught fire at all and are going nowhere in this campaign, which makes it for a very uncertain field.
Well, Tom,
if I could jump in, the thing is, this campaign right now is about three things: Iowa, New Hampshire, and money. And these campaigns in Iowa, New Hampshire, are very, very, very engaged. And so when you see these polls that, you know, X percent don't know, can't name a single candidate, that's the fact that somebody in Juneau, Alaska, doesn't know who the candidates are isn't really terribly relevant at this early stage.
Tom, one last question for you. The debate tonight is going to be broadcast simultaneously on PBS and Spanish-speaking Univision. Hispanics are the nation's largest and fastest-growing minority group. Governor Bill Richardson of New Mexico is Hispanic. He predicts fireworks tonight, by the way. But either way, what does the Hispanic vote and the way the candidates seem to be courting it, what does that mean?
Well, historically, Hispanics have not voted in great numbers. So there's a strong attempt now to mobilize Hispanic voters and to get them to turn out and to really enfranchise these folks and to get them politically engaged in a significant way. It has real consequence for Democrats, particularly in states like Texas, New Mexico, California, where there are large numbers of Hispanic voters who could begin to have real influence on the election. Republicans are also beginning to focus on Hispanic voters, of course. And in Texas, they're demonstrating some success in attracting conservative Hispanics to the party.
Well, we're going to hear more about that in just a second. But meanwhile, I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Professor Tom Holohan is Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California. Charlie Cook is editor and publisher of the Cook Political Report and political analyst for National Journal Magazine and NBC News.
Well, as we just heard, tonight's debate will be translated into Spanish. But will any candidate attempt to speak it? Debate organizers say they are unaware of any candidate who speaks the language fluently, though a couple have used it on the campaign trail. The GOP, too, knows the value of reaching out to Hispanic voters, which is one of the reasons more Republican politicians than ever before participated in a 10-week Spanish course on Capitol Hill this past summer. Some have even taken trips over the border for crash courses in the language. Well, joining us on the line now is Republican Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas. He took part in that summer class. And, Senator, buenos dias.
Buenos dias. ¿Cómo está?
Muy bien. Not bad. Not bad. How did the course go? What's it like for a guy from the Great Plains to wrap himself around the sort of speedy lilt of Spanish?
It's tough. And I've had people telling me, okay, look, we can do this whole paragraph here, but you've got too much of central United States accent to it. So why don't we just stick with this one and let's get this phrase out right.
Yeah. Senator, why is Spanish so important to the Republican Party?
I think it's important to us in the United States. A large growth in Hispanic population, integrating into the U.S. Workforce. I think it's important for us to be able to communicate. And it's also an understanding of a culture. How a culture addresses another person in their language really does tell you quite a bit about it.
Now, what did you do? Is it about flashcards in the back of the car while you're on your way into work? Tapes or?
What it's mostly been is just this class once a week and then practicing around Capitol Hill when I run into different people that speak Spanish. I hope to go to an intensive Spanish training course as well to really try to get my basic speaking skills up to a minimal conversation level. It's useful, obviously, here at home because of Spanish speakers, but also because of the number of Spanish speakers around the world. I do a lot in foreign policy, and it does touch another individual, if you will, communicate with them in their own language.
And, Senator, you've already expressed your growing interest in the culture itself. Is there any reason to criticize a politician for perhaps pandering a bit to an audience he's trying to lure into the voting booth by learning a bit of the language?
You know, a democracy is about representing the people and their desires and aspirations and trying to put that forward in words. I don't see that as pandering. I see that as trying to represent the people who are here. I think that's being responsible, actually.
Well, Senator, gracias.
De nada. Very good. Mucho bueno.
Muy bueno. Muy bien. Thank you so much, Senator, for making some time for us on this.
No problem. Thank you.
Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas, who took a course in Spanish this summer on Capitol Hill.
Just ahead, actress Jessica Lange is also the goodwill ambassador for UNICEF, and she's just back from the Democratic Republic of Congo. She wonders, why aren't more people paying attention to the systematic use of rape as a weapon of war?
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, government and rebel troops and six neighboring countries have been battling since 1998 over resources like cobalt and gold, raping, torturing, killing an estimated 3 million people. The rape of Congo, it's a phrase that's been used through Belgian colonization and fragile independence, but now it's taken on a new meaning. Actress and UN Goodwill Ambassador Jessica Lange recently returned from Congo. She joins us now from St. Paul, Minnesota. Hello there.
Hi.
Many people already know that rape is not about sex. In Congo, what is it about?
Well, it's used as a tactic of war, and of course this was not invented in the Congo. It's been used in many, many different wars. However, the endemic use of sexual violence against women and children, women and girls, in the Congo has reached such extraordinary... I mean, it is one of the largest humanitarian crises on the planet right now. Mm. It's being used as a tactic of war, basically to instill shame and fear within the communities. And it is a very systematic use of, of violence, sexual violence, as a weapon of war.
In fact, we hear that it's so woven into this fabric of the military that women are systematically raped during military operations. In other words, it's part of the operation.
Well, I think a lot of the problem, of course, is that these armies, you know, these ragtag militias, and there are dozens of them, they are not legitimate armies, legitimate in the sense that they are salaried or they are supported by different governments. So that when they are recruited, of course, a lot of the enticement is that they would have carte blanche to rape, to loot. You know, so it is a way of paying back the soldiers on the ground, really.
Mm. One statistic jumps out at me. Apparently, you met with rape victims at a doctor's on-call hospital where 48% of the patients are sexual assault victims. And, you know, one has to assume that's probably just a fraction of the women willing to come forward.
I think what we're seeing is just the tiniest tip of the iceberg. Because of the stigmata that is connected to rape, they're estimating that it could be as small as 1 in 1,000 women who are coming forward, maybe 1 in 10,000. These crimes are being committed with impunity. I mean, there are no consequences for the actions.
And they're being committed repetitively. You spoke to one young girl. I think her name is Cecily.
Yes.
Who had been systematically raped by not one but two different military groups. What was that like to talk to Cecily?
Well, first of all, she's one of the most beautiful young women. She's the same age as my second daughter, my daughter who's now a senior in high school. You know, so you look at somebody like her who has such incredible dignity and perseverance, and you wonder how you are all existing on the same planet, you know, that her life could be what it is and our life is what this is. And She spoke so calmly and so she was so forthright about what had happened to her. I mean, the brutality she suffered from multiple rapes by many, many different soldiers, to being wounded in an attack, to being left to die and being abandoned by various, you know, not just the different militias, but also by townspeople, by, you know, individual citizens who fear for reprisals. And finally, after months, made it to a hospital, miscarried, discovered that her leg was broken and she was suffering from terrible internal injuries, because a lot of times it's not just rape, that it goes beyond rape into kind of unfathomable mutilation of these women.
Mm. And it often goes to AIDS, because I think 15% of the country now is diagnosed with AIDS, and there's no services
for that. Okay. Yeah, I think that is just the very, very beginning. I think what we will see is something similar to Rwanda when it's all said and done with the spread of AIDS.
And some would say the diplomatic pressure also has to be put on neighboring Uganda to stop intervening in eastern Congo, countries in the area.
Yes. I mean, all the bordering countries, Uganda and Rwanda. And I mean, when I was there, I saw a young girl, 4 years old, who had been brought into a hospital, the Médecins Sans Frontières, who had been slashed all across her face, her neck, her back, her arms. Her hands were hanging off. It seems insane to me that there is no attention being paid.
It's competing with a lot of things for people's attention, as you know.
It is as important as anything else that's going on in the world right now.
Mm. Well, you, as others, would urge pressure be put on the foreign predators who as you've said, have been raping the resources of Congo, put pressure on the ethnic rivalries, more UN forces on the ground. The Hague is considering war crime trials, and it just feels as if, you know, where would they start? It feels as if just about every side is culpable.
Well, I think you have to start at the top. You have to work your way down the chain of command. You know, the lowliest soldier in the field has been, like I said before, has been given carte blanche. So, you know, you have to go to the commanders of these different militia and begin to hold them accountable.
Mm. Jessica Lang, you've obviously, you feel very strongly about this. What about Hollywood, a movie, something, you know, again, it's so off most people's radar.
Yes.
Could it ever even approach it, or?
I don't know. You know, it's been humanitarian causes have not always been big, you know, a big draw for Hollywood studios.
Jessica Lang, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate being able to speak about this.
Jessica Lang, actress and goodwill ambassador for UNICEF, talking about her recent visit to war-ravaged areas of the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll look at the single most deadly and now almost completely forgotten catastrophe in New York City before 9/11.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
We'll be right back.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, Alabama taxpayers are being asked to vote for the biggest tax increase in that state's history, and many Republican lawmakers are behind it.
The sun's going to shine on Wednesday, whether this thing passes or not. It just matters as to who's going to pay for it.
And remembering the brilliant career of critic Kenneth Tynan.
Here was a writer who was funny, who used every arrow in the quiver when it came to writing. He used irony, parody, put-downs. He could be intellectual. He could be passionate. Anything a writer could be, he was.
These stories coming up Here and Now.
I'm Dolores Handy. The leaders of Germany and France today criticized a U.S. draft resolution seeking international troops and money for rebuilding Iraq, saying it falls short. German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder and French President Jacques Chirac say the United Nations should guide Iraq's political rebuilding and that more responsibility must be turned over to Iraqi leaders. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld is in Iraq in an effort to assess the security situation there. Lourdes Navarro reports from Baghdad.
This is Donald Rumsfeld's second visit to Iraq since U.S. forces took control of the country, and it comes at a critical time. The security situation in the wake of 4 car bombings is tenuous at best, and the Secretary of Defense is here to see firsthand the conditions and talk to military and civilian leaders. He began by doing just that, shaking hands with troops at Baghdad's international airport, where he arrived. He briefly visited wounded soldiers in a hospital tent, the victims of the almost a dozen attacks that U.S. forces face here daily. Lourdes Navarro, Baghdad.
One of President Bush's controversial judicial nominees has withdrawn his name from consideration for a U.S. appeals court seat. Miguel Estrada, an immigrant from Honduras, says in a letter to the president he needs to devote full attention to the practice of law and to regain the ability to make long-term plans for his family. Estrada was nominated 2 years ago, but Democrats filibustered, saying he lacked judicial experience and he was too conservative to serve in the nation's second highest court. Members of Congress could be giving themselves a pay raise. Lawmakers, along with more than 1 million other civilian government workers, are in line for a 4.1% pay raise next year under legislation moving through the House today. It would boost their salaries above $160,000 a year from the present $154,000. The Pentagon has approved the use of a push-button bugle to play taps at military funerals. There are only about 500 buglers on active duty in any one day. About 1,800 people with military service die each day and are eligible for honor ceremonies. Officials say a real bugler will still be used when available. The government says new claims for unemployment benefits are at their highest level since mid-July. Productivity is way up as businesses produce more with fewer workers. On Wall Street, stocks are mixed. The Dow is up. The Nasdaq is down. It's 12:33.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
A federal appeals court in Philadelphia has temporarily blocked a change in FCC media ownership rules that were due to take effect today. pending the result of a lawsuit filed in opposition to those rules. The controversial regulations would relax restrictions on the ownership of TV and radio stations by networks and newspapers. The rules were approved by Federal Communications Chairman Michael Powell with the support of his Republican colleagues earlier this year. But they've drawn bipartisan opposition in the House and Senate and from citizens groups as diverse as the National Rifle Association and Code Pink Women for Peace. Well, yesterday's ruling was a temporary victory for detractors. The appeals court was careful not to comment on the merits of the case that prompted the block. So what is that case? We're joined now by Petrie Dish. Yes, that's his real name, technical director of the Prometheus Radio Project, the community radio advocacy organization that brought the suit. And Pete, start by telling us a little more about what your organization does.
What Prometheus does is we advocate for and we help build non-commercial community radio stations around the country. We intervened in this case because, you know, we know what's happened to radio, and we speak to people that are refugees from the radio industry all the time that actually, you know, they might have been in commercial radio a couple of years ago, but now they're setting up low-power radio stations because they've been knocked out of the business by the Clear Channels of the world.
Tell us, what is your argument against the rules?
Well, essentially, what we have is a situation where fewer and fewer companies are able to control more and more of the news and information and entertainment that the American public sees, and a lot of us see that as really dangerous. Mm-hmm. My own biggest concern is that you have a corporation like, say, General Electric, which is a major manufacturer of nuclear weapons, of nuclear power plants, a major, major polluter. They own NBC. And so how can people really trust NBC as a news outlet when they have a special interest with such a strong agenda behind them?
Well, as we've said, there are many groups and senators and congressmen from both parties who agree with you. They've argued that this relaxation of media ownership rules is not in the public interest. But is it illegal? I mean, how do you make that argument?
Well, basically what happened in the courts is that a lot of arguments were brought up about the procedures by which this move was pushed through. And so there were lots of things that came out in the new rules that were never really discussed in the rulemakings that preceded it. And ordinarily in a federal rulemaking like this, the rules stem out of the public debate that came before that. And so a lot of the arguments sort of hinged on some of the things like the diversity index, the change that allowed non-commercial stations to be counted as part of the commercial radio market, thus creating the impression of more diversity than there really is.
I see. So while you feel that it's bad law, what you're arguing in the courts is the process under which the ruling was made. Well, some of those who agree with you are seeing the court's block of the regulations as sort of an opening to do more lobbying of Congress. But the White House has a veto of Congress.
That is true. But what I think we're seeing is that as unresponsive as our political system can be at times, when you get so many people behind an idea, suddenly you see motion in all parts of government. You know, a couple times the judges yesterday cited the millions of comments that came into the FCC on this issue. And I think that the White House won't be blind to that either. I'm not going to bet on horse races or anything like that. But what I will say is that the more people step forward and make their views known, eventually the politicians are going to take notice and listen.
Well, Pete, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Petrie Dish is the technical director of the Prometheus Radio Project. He spoke to us from Philadelphia.
Taxes, usually a dirty word and notorious third rail in politics. But now the Republican governor of Alabama is lending his support to a move to increase taxes in his state in an effort to slash the state's budget deficit of $675 million. The increase, which is being voted on in a referendum next week, would be the state's largest in history. Well, joining me on the line is Alabama State Representative and Republican David Grimes. Hello, Representative.
Thank you, sir. Hello.
Hello, and thanks for joining us. Congressman, you voted to support this measure back in June. Now it's up to the voters. What are you hearing from your constituents?
I hear a lot from my constituents concerning that Alabama will gain from this because it helps us in a lot of areas, economic reform. There's a lot of restructuring of the government process. There's a lot of accountability that we feel that this program will bring to the state of Alabama and help us for many, many years to come.
But this is strange territory for a Republican raising taxes.
Well, you know, I don't look at it as Republicans raising taxes. I look at it as a man that wants to be known as a statesman that's looking for generations ahead. And he walked in and he found some problems with the plumbing, and he wants to fix it. He didn't just walk back out and say, let's patch it to the next guy. So I commend him for the courageous move that he's taken to step forward and say, look, I know that I'm committing political suicide, but this has got to be done. And I really do applaud him for having the courage and intestinal fortitude to do that.
You know, our Republican administration in Washington has been cutting taxes despite a lot of things that are not paid for in this country. What is your attitude toward the Bush administration cutting taxes?
People do what they have to do to make things turn out the way they need to turn out, typically. I applaud President Bush and everything he's done. I'm a big supporter of President Bush. Glad he's there. And I don't equate our problems to his or those of the country. We have our own axes to grind, and I really believe that we have a handle on this if we can understand that the people of Alabama are going to vote one way or the other on Tuesday. And let me tell you, we're going to make it. The sun's going to shine on Wednesday whether this thing passes or not. Huh. It just matters as to who's going to pay for it.
You know, Representative, what we read today is that 2 out of 3 voters in Alabama plan to vote against this at this point.
That may be true, but I don't think so. I believe we're going to be, I may be wrong, but I think it's going to be closer to 50-50. Now, I may be, I guess you say, naive, because my district is more in line with agreeing with the package. I've had hundreds of phone calls from constituents, and the sentiment has been something to the degree of this is a bad situation that we have to put ourselves into, but I'm ready to do something about it. It's going to cost me X number of dollars. And these are fairly affluent people. I have a fairly affluent district. Mm-hmm. I'll say, without being disrespectful to anybody, it's more the upper crust, and they are for the plan. The only people I've had call me with negative comments are my very, very large landowners, and it's because of the property tax, ad valorem tax on large tracts of land is going to go up, say, 300-400%. And that's, you know, we're only paying $1.25 an acre now. So saying 300% is still $4.50. So mm-hmm. we get a little carried away with the percentages.
I see. Do you see Alabama in any way as possibly a model for other states wrestling with big deficits?
Many, many, many other states have much higher deficits than Alabama. But I do see us in a model statute because we have a Republican governor who has he is known for his posture in not raising taxes on a national level. And the first thing he does is walk in and see that there's bats in the belfry, and he's got to do something about it. And he has done a very good job of selling this program to the people who least understand it.
State Representative David Grimes, thanks very much for joining us on Here and Now.
Well, thank you. I hope that this helps a little.
Alabama State Representative David Grimes.
Still to come, our theater critic Bill Marks on legendary theater critic Kenneth Tynan.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's Thursday when we open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Well, a lot of listeners responded to our Labor Day interview with John Malloy, the high-tech worker who has been looking for a job for over 2 years. Several people in the same boat responded, like Adrian Hlinka of Groton, Massachusetts. I was laid off twice as a software engineer. In almost 2 years, I have sent out lots of resumes, had maybe a dozen phone interviews, and only a handful of in-person interviews. I finally realized that not only can I not get a job like I had before, but I don't want one. I started a little business fixing computers and solving computer-related problems for small businesses and home users. And I got a very blue-collar part-time job loading trucks for UPS. I don't know if I am the only Ivy League graduate loading packages in my plant, but I guess it doesn't matter. I'm making about a quarter of my previous pay, but I am very happy to be at least covering my living costs.
Well, we also received a lot of advice for John on our listener line, including this tongue-in-cheek message from Ken Edwards of Scottsdale, Arizona.
You asked what he could do to help himself find a job before Labor Day next year. Elect a new president. That's it. Have a great day. I'm in the same situation. It's unbelievable. The unemployment rate is not what it really is. It does not represent the true number of people who do not have a job out there. And this has just been a sham.
Well, last week we heard the voices of vacationers in Utah with their thoughts on the breakdown of the roadmap for peace in the Middle East. Ingrid Pavlovsky of Providence, Rhode Island, took issue with one of them. She writes, she expressed the view that Palestinians placed no value on human life, that they don't feel the same way we do about these things. Her comments reflect the same ignorance and stupidity that black people have struggled to overcome in America and elsewhere.
In a report on the California governor's race, we quoted Arnold Schwarzenegger, who disavowed comments he made in the soft porn magazine We because he said he was young, 29, and not yet thinking of running for governor, which prompted Larry Lopez to write, Monica was 21, W was under 40, Arnold was 29. Gee, I considered myself an adult by 21. Does adolescence now continue right up to senility?
Well, we also got several nominees to our Unsung Actors Hall of Fame. Larry Wolfe in Phoenix, Arizona, picked Tim Roth in 1995's Rob Roy, while Stuart Spinner of Wilmington, Delaware, opted for Chris Cooper and Mary McDonnell in the 1987 film Matewan.
And finally, a grammar oops. Several listeners picked up our use of the word irregardless. The prefix IR would actually turn regardless into not regardless, but regardless. Jonathan Spencer writes, I wince when I hear it, but I usually expect to hear it on the street or from an interviewee. Bill, your language filter needs a tune-up.
All right, the 100,000-mile checkup. Thank you. Well, regardless, we do love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters at here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your name, include your phone number, and the town where you live.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Theater critics, they can make or break a show, but really good critics provide provocative ideas, great writing, and often become a dramatic figure in their own right. Critic Kenneth Tynan fits that mold. Through the 50s and 60s, Tynan was theater critic for London's Observer and Evening Standard and The New Yorker, and left reviewing in the 60s when Laurence Olivier hired him to be the dramaturg for the brand new National Theatre in London. Well, now a new book celebrates Kenneth Tynan the critic and his colorful life. It's written by Dominic Shellard, and we've invited Here Now's theatre critic Bill Marks to come in and give us a review and to inform us about Mr. Tynan. Hello, Mr. Marks.
Hi, Robin.
Well, Kenneth Tynan, his name resonates so for many people. What did he feel the role of the critic was supposed to be?
Well, first I'm going to read a little bit of Tynan to say what he thought it wasn't. And he says here, a mediocre drama critic may be defined as a man who is content merely to review plays. He comes to the theater as a high school gourmet to a restaurant, equipped with nothing more positive than an open mind and a clean palate. Having tasted the dish that is set before him, he pronounces it pleasant or unpleasant and then goes home to gargle. Well, it's not about gargling for Tynan, and for me, neither is reviewing about gargling. I mean, it's not about reviewing a show thumbs up or thumbs down, and that basically for Tynan is what a critic wasn't supposed to do. A critic was there to help discriminate, to excite and provoke ideas in the reader, to lead, hopefully lead the theater to better things by, in a sense, saying this is what's wrong and then pointing out those things that are good to say, and this is what's right. This is what could make theater better.
So tell us, where does he fit in? I mean, in the hierarchy, in the firmament of critics, where would you say he is?
Well, critics are not particularly well respected. So to even talk about a hierarchy, I think most people already are throwing strawberries or whatever, not too happy. To me, he fits in as, of the last century, probably one of the finest critics we've had. He helped really create, let's say, paved the way for an entirely new and exciting form of theater. Because when he started in the early 50s, you know, it was Noel Coward, it was English Country Houses, comedy, it was Christopher Fry, you know, poetic drama, drama written in verse. And he said, out with all that stuff. I want drama that deals with reality, with what's happening politically. And so it was his, even before Look Back in Anger happened in 1956, and his review of that essentially helped kick off and made that play and made John Osborne and created that movement of sort of social realism.
So that Look Back in Anger, for instance, you're saying that he helped make that show?
He helped make that show. It was his review in The Guardian essentially saying, and I'm paraphrasing, I could not love anybody who didn't go to Look Back in Anger and not like it. Essentially, and that's the kind of critic he was, that helped make Osborne was a brand new playwright. This came out of nowhere. And Tynan embraced it because he saw that this is part of what he was looking for. He was looking for a play which reflected contemporary English reality, which was filled with passion and anger, and wanted some sort of social change, because that's very much what Tynan was into.
Give us some more samples of his writing. You have some quips there?
Well, I can a little bit. I mean, there's just so many great things that it's sort of hard just to pick one or two. I mean, we're talking about Tynan's verdicts. I also want to talk about Tynan, how he used words so well, often to write about actors. There are very few critics, particularly theater critics, who write well about acting. It's probably the hardest thing to do.
Why is that?
Well, because it's hard to evoke the physical characteristics of what makes a performance good. When you think about it, you can say Marlon Brando, good actor in On the Waterfront, but to describe precisely why he was so good. What did he bring physically? What did he bring besides the white T-shirt? Now, this is a wonderful quote, which I like, which is about Ralph Richardson's voice. And here is what Tynan wrote. The vocal equivalent of onion skin writing paper, suave, crackling, and resonant. Now, I love the language there, and he does get that papery quality to Richardson's voice, that vocal equivalent of onion skin writing paper. See, I think that's brilliant writing, and it gives you an idea of why that voice is so distinctive.
He could also use it to condemn his writing skills. I'm thinking of the actress Vivian Leigh.
Yeah, Vivian Leigh, he loved Olivier.
And, of course, Vivian Leigh was married to Laurence Olivier.
And perhaps it is his sort of jealous romance for Olivier and the greatness of his acting that he couldn't think anyone could be a match or a mate for Olivier. And he saved some special, let's say, acid for Vivian Leigh. And here's one which actually is not as acidic as some of the others, but which I think gives you an idea of what he had to say about her. And this is her performance, I believe, with Olivier in Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra. Taking a deep breath and resolutely focusing her periwinkle charm, she launches another of her careful readings. Ably and passionately, she picks her way among its great challenges, presenting a glibly mown lawn where her author had imagined a jungle. So, I mean, the image is, I mean, really sort of nails an actress who perhaps has a certain limited amount of talent and changes a great wild role into something that's very sort of domesticated and neat.
Well, it's a danger to enjoy anyone being criticized, you know, especially you and I sitting here on the air. But I have a little more of what he wrote about her. It's just, he writes, Leigh picks at the part with the daintiness of a debutante called upon to dismember a stag.
Well, yes, that was, I think that was about her performance in Titus Andronicus, I believe.
Well,
anyway.
Anyway.
But no, but that, look, what do you want? Do you want criticism that basically is bland and says Vivian Leigh wasn't very good or I didn't like her or basically just says, well, she's a great star, so I have to say she's good? Or do you have someone respond to it passionately?
Well, perhaps because he was so critical when he was critical, it sort of, you know, made it fair game that someone would lay his life bare in this new book. I mean, mentioned his colorful life, and I think we should probably not dwell on the spanking that he's
seen. We should put that in some sort of context. Tynan was a very colorful figure in the theater and often wore purple suits and polka dot ties. I mean, he was great. He came in, everyone saw him. He was an exhibitionist and very theatrical. His sex life, unfortunately, has become more and more to the fore, which was also, I guess you would say, a bit different, because when his, just I think about a year or two ago, his journals were published, and there in graphic detail was his infatuation, obsession with spanking.
Hello.
And it essentially destroyed two marriages. He was also very much, when the 60s came about, very much embraced the idea of sexual freedom, sexual experimentation, and O Calcutta, which was the, you know, sort of the naughty sexual review that he wrote or compiled. And when you talk about him in England now, it's hard to talk about him seriously because everyone brings up the sort of the sexual and the pornographic. What I like about this book is that it really highlights what's most important about Tynan, which is that for a 10-year period, he was one of the great theater critics of the century. Mm. Not only in terms of how great he wrote, not only in terms of the flamboyance of his personality, but he actually did what most critics dream of, which is he really helped, was a catalyst, if nothing else, for one of the most explosive movements in drama, you know, I mean, in England since the Renaissance. Mm. And that was Look Back in Anger and all the social realists.
How did he die?
He died in 1980. He had emphysema, which grew progressively worse. So he died in 1980 from this lung ailment.
It sounds as if you are saying, if any young person thinks that they have it in them to criticize someone on the boards, that they should pick up this book first.
When I first started being a theater critic, I essentially sat down and read a lot of criticism. I mean, I said, well, let's look at the models. Who were the good ones? And everyone said, you must read Kenneth Tynan. And I read him, and he was a great influence on me when early on as a critic. Here was a writer who was funny, who used every arrow in the quiver when it came to writing. He used irony, parody, put-downs. He could be intellectual. He could be passionate. He could be, you know, anything a writer could be, he was. And he invigorated the language. And by invigorating the language, it proved that he took theater seriously. The irony of Tynan's career, which is sort of brought out in the book, is that although he was a great critic, he didn't appreciate his own greatness as a critic. He always wanted to become a practical part of the theater. He wanted to become a dramaturg in the National Theater. He wanted to be a director. He wanted to be a playwright. And essentially, he stopped doing the very thing that he was a genius at, to work at things that he was not nearly as good at.
Too bad he didn't get to meet Bill Marx first.
I don't know if I don't know what I would have done meeting Tynan. I think he probably would have, you know, sliced and diced me in about 30 seconds, and then, you know what I mean? I would have been done.
But before that, you could have told him what a role model he had been.
Yes.
Well, Bill, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Here Now's theater critic Bill Marx. For more on the book Kenneth Tynan, A Life, go to our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories Here and Now.
We'll look at the single most deadly and now almost completely forgotten catastrophe in New York City before 9/11.
And we take a look at America's infrastructure, our roads and bridges falling apart at the seams.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.